Here on Ezekiel 20, we really have God appealing to Israel to accept the new covenant of grace. And he does so by convicting them of their sin. And he talks about how they were idolatrous right from Egypt, and how totally gracious he was, and how he is characterized by saving them despite their total failure to meet his conditions. Despite them not repenting, he still saves them and pushes forward his saving purpose with them. Verse 6, he says that, I swore to them to bring them out of the land of Egypt into a land that I had searched out for them. And I said to them, verse 7, throw away every man the abominations of his eyes, and don't defile yourselves with the idols of Egypt. I am Yahweh your God. So it was whilst they were in Egypt that he appeared to them and said, basically, drop your idols and I will save you out of here. Now that is not recorded specifically in the Exodus record, but it is stated here. And yet they didn't. Verse 8, they rebelled against me and would not listen to me. They did not throw away the abominations, neither did they forsake the idols of Egypt. But God still led them out of Egypt with those idols which they did not forsake. Now, let's get that clear. They left Egypt cuddling the idols of Egypt, those gods, or images of those gods, whom clearly the plagues had judged, because the plagues were upon the gods of Egypt. You can work out quite clearly that each of the plagues was targeting a particular one of the gods that Egypt had. Despite all that, they did not totally give themselves to Yahweh, but instead they took the idols of Egypt with them. Amos 5, quoted by Stephen in Acts 7, it's very clear that they carried the star of their god Remphan with them through the desert, in addition to the stars or the standards of the tribes, which they also had to carry. And they also carried the tabernacle of Moloch. Well, they carried the tabernacle of Yahweh, but they also carried the tabernacle of Moloch. This is incredible. Now, we also can, as it were, smuggle the idols of this world through the waters of baptism, because Israel crossing the Red Sea is a type of our baptism. Paul's clear about that, 1 Corinthians 10. So the whole thing opens up as a very challenging parable, that the act of baptism is very much God saving you, rather than you taking a great initiative to, I don't know, save yourself, as it were. Sure, you've taken an initiative, you have agreed, just like Israel did agree, they didn't stay in Egypt. And yet, as we know, as God says, in their hearts, they return to Egypt. At one point, they say, let's make us a captain and return to Egypt. And they keep on saying how much better life was in Egypt than it was living with God. So, they really were awful. They were terribly unfaithful to God. And yet, we're told in Ezekiel 16 and other places, Jeremiah 2, that God fell in love with Israel in the desert, that at Mount Sinai he spread, as it were, his garment over them and accepted them and entered into a marriage covenant with them. And yet they turned out to be a prostitute. But God saw them as beautiful, despite them still having these idols with them. In fact, God was so angry with them when they were in Egypt, and when he meets them through Moses, that he says in verse 8, then I said I would pour out my wrath on them to accomplish my anger against them in the midst of the land of Egypt. But I worked for my name's sake that it should not be profaned. So he actually intended to destroy them in Egypt. But he didn't. He said, I worked for my name's sake, the working. What does that mean? Well, I think the idea is that the pole of God's saving grace sort of worked against the pole of his justifiable anger and necessary judgment upon them. And he says that he did this Well, it says here, so that my name shouldn't be mocked in the eyes of the nations. I've often thought about that, and, you know, is it so that God was really scared of what people might think of him? That is not at all characteristic of the God of Israel, to be unduly bothered what the nations think of him. I wonder if he's almost making an excuse to sort of justify what quite simply was a decision of love, that was the triumph of grace and of love and of a senseless grace over, as I say, the pole of necessary judgment that was within him. We read the same thing in Hosea, where he says, how can I give you up, Ephraim? My repentings, my changes of mind are kindled together within me. The whole book of Hosea is about this, where God on one hand says, I will slay you with thirst. I will send you back to Egypt. And then he says, you shall not return to Egypt. I shall love them freely. And the contorted feelings of Hosea to his wife Gomer, who was a prostitute, and yet he loved her so deeply, all this reflected the love of God for Israel. So the depth of their failure was really quite spectacular. Despite all that, verse 10, I caused them to go forth out of the land of Egypt and brought them into the wilderness. Now, all the way through, you read about him causing them to leave Egypt. He caused this. Find that phrase quite often in these chapters. Well, yes, God did this. He caused it to happen, because this was all of his mighty hand, as he says often. It was not for your sakes, it was not for the sake of your obedience to me, but for my name's sake that I saved you. And his name is essentially grace. That is essentially what he revealed himself as to Moses when Moses says, who are you? Show me your name, show me your glory. And God declares his name in response to that. And, you know, he is a God who does judge sin. He is a God of justice, and yet he is this God of grace and of forgiveness, and in the end of love, to an extent that you and I can never quite understand. So he brings them out, even though he wanted to destroy them. He brings them out by grace alone. And, of course, the idea is that he's prepared to do the same to the exiles in Babylon, even though they were not repentant, even though they had not responded to the command, leave Babylon, flee Babylon. He wanted to almost force through his purpose with them to save them. So he harks back again to the wilderness. Verse 18, I said to their children in the wilderness, don't walk in the ways of your fathers. Don't defile yourselves with their idols. So the fathers in the wilderness had their idols with them. But the children rebelled against me. They didn't chuck away mum and dad's idols. And I think that would therefore imply that they took them with them over the Jordan River into the land of promise. But on the way there, I said I would pour out my wrath upon them to accomplish my anger against them in the wilderness, just as he said in Egypt that he was going to destroy them in Egypt. But then he relents, and you remember how he says to Moses, leave me alone, Moses, I'm just going to destroy them, and I will make of you a great nation. I'll carry on my saving purpose that I promised to Abraham through you, not through them. But he relents. Verse 33 then says, look, God says, surely with a mighty hand and a stretched out arm and with wrath poured out will I be king over you. Now, they didn't want really God to be their king. They rejected him and they wanted a human kingship. But when he talks about my mighty hand will do this, my stretched out arm will do this, it's as if all his might is put into saving people almost, and I have to keep saying almost, despite of themselves. I will cause you to pass under the rod and I will bring you into the bond of the covenant. Notice, I will bring you. I will gather you in to the bond of the covenant. The idea was that the shepherd stood at the door of the sheepfold. Only one shepherd could come in or out at a time. And he had in his hand a rod that was dipped in red dye, and he branded the sheep. And of course, we then are those who have been brought into that new covenant. And we are those who take the cup to symbolize that. All this amazing saving grace and outstretched arm has been shown to us.